Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hello and welcome to this week's New Statesman interview. This week I'm joined by Owen Kingston and Tom Black, the director and writer of Crisis What Crisis, an immersive theatre experience by The Parabolic, which allows you to try and save the 1974 to 1979 Labour government's bacon. So I'm joined by the writer and director of Crisis What Crisis, an interactive theatre experience about the 1974 to 79 Labour government, in which you, the audience, are given the task of keeping the rickety wheel that was that Labour government going. So something I'm sure loads of Venice podcast listeners will be very interested in. I'm hoping to go later on in the run, but I got actually that kind of weird mid thing where you're not pinged, but where a friend phones you and says, oh, I've tested positive. I'm waiting for, waiting to find out whether or not. It's like, and in an odd way, I realise I find that more annoying. Why do I have to go through this process of finding out for myself whether or not I have this?
We had a cancel show off the back of exactly that back in June before we started on this run. It's really annoying. Limbo space to be in.
So I'm very controlling. And one of the things I've always been very impressed by with any form of theatre, I remember Simon Stevens once talking about, you can't legislate for what the audience will laugh at, and sometimes they'll laugh at something and you will go, okay, well, you people don't get me at all. Obviously, this is something in which the audience actually gets to be in control. So what is that like as a director, who I'm afraid I always imagine directors as being quite controlling, probably because like many controlling people, I like to imagine it's a widespread problem.
It's so much fun when you get into it. But to start with, it is absolutely terrifying. And when we first started doing this a few years ago, we did this with a show that was set during the Second World War. The narrative of the show was an alternate history, Second World War, where Britain was being invaded by the Nazis. The audience became the war cabinet through a series of unfortunate events. Parliament gets destroyed and they're designated survivors, and suddenly they're up and they have to run the country. When we started doing it, we genuinely didn't know whether it was going to work or completely fall apart into a total mess. So obviously we put as much work as possible into trying to make sure that it couldn't fall apart. And that meant creating quite a strong structure narratively for the show, because I've been to plenty of improvised things in the past where it does just sort of send into chaos. So we made sure that we had a very strong narrative structure with certain plot beats happening at certain times, based off film structure, really, the idea that there need to be certain emotional beats that land at certain places in order to feel like it's a story well told. But we didn't prescribe the detail of what those beats would be. We just knew the places in the show where they had to come. So we decided on various things that could happen at those points. And then the decisions of the audience meant that one or other of those things would fall. And then that could determine the things that happened later in the show. And it meant that the whole thing stayed within a sensible, like the chaos stayed contained within a good shell that could hold it and still leave you feeling like you'd experienced a good story. But precisely what the things happened were was down to the audience's decisions. And that's the same model that we've taken in making this show. We've just sort of dialed it up to 11, really.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the challenge we have when setting out with this is because when I originally pitched the idea to Owen, it was not long after we'd finished one of the runs of this World War II show, and I suggested it as a board game initially, because I didn't really think, you know, well, is there enough drama theatricality in The Winter of Discontent and Parliamentary Procedure? However, Owen very quickly said, I think there is a show here, and so suddenly we grabbed the challenge of, like, well, the Second World War, it's obvious that people are going to buy into those stakes. There's an obvious audience there.
No one wants the Nazis to win on their watch.
Exactly.
You know, it's a real good juicy enemy to put people against.
Exactly. But then when we were starting from a new blank piece of paper and saying, like, we're going to get people to care about inflation in 1979, that was a rather different, perhaps lower stakes to some people think. But what's been wonderful is that audiences really do buy in. Even sort of, you know, sceptical or confused audience members, they often come up to us afterwards and they'll say, in the first 20 minutes I was a bit like, what is this? But by the end I was pumping the air and really being excited with everyone else, like, really bought in. And as Owen says, that's because the structure that we use in all our shows in Parabolic in some way, shape or form rewards audience input and agency to a major degree, and you can feel that things you did earlier on are going to properly change things later on.
Inevitably, not least because many of our listeners will have seen it on the National Theatre Live or seen it when it's been on tour, the comparison people will draw is with This House, which is a regular play. I think James... Yeah. Which James Graham once jokingly compared to, you know, it's a bit like the Star Wars prequels, right? You know at the end then Darth Vader arrives, and, you know, the final image of This House is Darth Vader arriving. Now, of course, the magic of your play is people can avert the rise of Darth Vader if they so choose. I mean, as you were writing it, talk me through, what is the process of writing this type of play about a historical event where the audience can change history as
well? Well, given what Owen was saying about the structure and how we operate, it obviously long sort of scripted sections with agreed dialogue and stuff are very rare in things like this. You occasionally have a few here and there to kind of tell something very clearly, because if you're trying to explain to the audience that what they do matters, it's good to have that in quite a controlled way. But broadly speaking, the big task was actually coming up with, well, doing a lot of research, figuring out the timeline, modifying a few things. Of course, in the show, we have actually mashed together a few things. Obviously, the Winter of Discontent didn't all happen across one night, really. And of course, the Winter of Discontent was actually over by the time the famous motion of no confidence happened. It was actually a couple of months, but we've sort of, for dramatic reasons, made it all happening on one night. So that was an early decision that was made on the writing front. But the big thing is actually creating the characters, because you start from, well, again, started from a blank piece of paper and was like, right, who are the archetypes, the kinds of people you'd expect to see in A, something that's a piece of political theatre, but B, something that is a different era to now. So in the 1970s, we started from like, okay, well, politics is going to look a bit different. There's going to be more outwardly, for example, more people with more regional accents. We wrote that down as like a basic thing of like, actually going back in time to the 70s, you would find more people that have come through the trade union movement to sort of right at the top of politics. You would have representatives of different parts of the media, different parts of, say, the trade union movement itself. I started with sort of these sort of kind of stock ideas, and then started working with some actors quite quickly on who they would be, and then gave them lots of lovely, well, not too much research to do and too much backstory, but having written them a few paragraphs here and there, and then start sort of improvising with them and creating a sense of like, right, okay, so at the various beats in the show, we're going to need you represent the Treasury, you're from the trade union, for example, you're going to be in this scene, let's make you comfortable with it. And very quickly, we ended up going into rehearsal and started sort of practicing things.
And the key thing is they have to be able to improvise in character with knowledge of the period and, you know, not be able to be caught out by people who know what they're, you know the period very well.
Because some people try.
Oh, yes, yeah. You know, when there's a certain audience type that comes to this kind of thing that wants to try and poke holes in it or find out where the joins are. And in order to get the thing to feel immersive, to feel like you're there, that you're in that world and part of the same world as the actors, it has to be as seamless as possible. And we have to try and avoid the audience banging into walls, you know, like the edge of the experience. So that working hard on that is a big thing for us.
Yeah, in terms of the people who want to see the joins, I've spoken to several people who've gone to see the play, one of whom is a Treasury official who obviously came in very much kind of like, you know, well, I've thought a lot about how I could have done this differently. And the other person is a massive theatre enthusiast. So similarly, it's kind of very interested in the craft of doing it, and therefore also has this kind of like, okay, well, I'm really intrigued to see where I can poke. I mean, obviously, all audience is lovely, but which of those types is the one that kind of gave you the most sort of sleepless nights in the writing process and the directing process?
When it comes to the writing, I think it is the former sort of the politics heads, because often they're also history heads, and as you just touched on, they are the ones who like to poke holes in it sometimes. I mean, the best feeling is when someone comes along, maybe because in the beginning of the show, before it kicks off, we sort of gradually let the audience in and they can walk around the office that you're in. During that bit, you sometimes find people sort of poking holes at things and wanting to talk to actors and catch them out. Often when they realise that's going to be quite hard because the actors are very on it and all of the information in the room is broadly accurate. Like, one little thing is someone complimented us a couple of nights ago on all the people that you can phone during the show, because one of the things that we've done in a few shows is that the phones in the room actually work. They're all connected to a different room and there's actors in there answering the phone. All the people you can talk to are the real people you would talk to. So it's all the MPs have got their real names, all the leaders of the various trade unions and so on. And so that often goes a long way to making people go, like, oh, okay, no, this isn't just some sort of 70s cosplay operation. We are, you know, really there. Those people are the most intimidating people to sort of try and get on side, because then one of the most difficult they can be is when they've decided in their head that something would happen a certain way, and then because of the way we've structured the show, or indeed just a different historical opinion, that thing doesn't necessarily happen that way. They start sort of arguing, and they feel a bit like the misnomer representation of King Canute at that point, where they're just arguing with the tide, and we have to find a way of in-world being like, no, that has happened this way. You might not think it should have done, because the show obviously is so built on, you know, it's like being an episode of The Thick of It, as some reviews have said. Like, if that happens, we just try and fold it in and make them see the funny side of, like, well, I'm sure you did expect that to happen a certain way, but actually inflation's gone up by 4%. That's going to be a problem. How are we going to fix it now? You know, embrace the chaos and make it fun. That's I guess the most intimidating type is this.
When we started out making this show, we didn't really intend to make a farce, but it is a sort of interactive political farce, and I think that's partly due to the events of the time. You know, truth is stranger than fiction, and there's some pretty wild things in there that, that end up being quite amusing when you're doing it.
And the best ones are often actually the things the audience decide to do on the night, just things that we hadn't really thought of. Things that's the wonderful thing with the structure that we've got, is there is space for brand new things. Like last night, and only last night, the whole audience, thanks to a snap decision made in the opening half hour, got obsessed with buying £31 million worth of bacon from West Germany as part of some backroom deal organised by Roy Jenkins over in Brussels, and it was going to help us out with something. But long after that problem had actually been resolved in exchange for the bacon purchase, we were still like, hang on a minute, we've now got £31 million worth of bacon, and it's headed to Felixstowe, and Felixstowe is actually going to see rioting quite soon. So is this bacon going to get, you know, what's going to happen
it's
to the bacon?
It's just going to sit on the dock.
Yeah, so the press, because the press obviously are a factor in the show, the actors doing the press stuff were suddenly being like, what's going on with this bacon? Is this you know, the British government said it's bringing home the bacon, literally. So again, none of that had ever happened before, but it was all because of an audience member getting interested in some bacon deal in West Germany.
Obviously, said it kind of started life as an idea for a board game, and it obviously just feels very reminiscent of certain kind of sessions of Dungeons and Dragons, where the players kind of go like, oh, I'm going to go down this kind of slightly weird rabbit hole. Why 74 to 79?
Well, I do love this house. That was a big factor. But actually, I got into 70s politics a few years ago. I actually wrote a book. My friend Jack Tyndale wrote a book called Agent Lavender, The Flight of Harold Wilson, which was an alternate history about what if Wilson had actually been a KGB spy. Obviously, he wasn't, but this is in that world where he gets found out as being such. And that really got me into the area. I did a lot of, obviously, research and reading for that. And I started, it felt, I don't know, for me, it felt a bit like a sort of forgotten about era as well. This was actually just before I'd seen this house. And there are many parallels with now. It's about, and actually I think the Star Wars prequels thing is a really good example. Of course, it applies to this house, but also to this, of like, yes, I was born in 1990. I very much grew up in the post-80s world and what had happened to the West and certainly to the UK economy. This idea of there was something different before that, this popular history probably goes, you know, Churchill wins the war, Attlee builds the NHS, some other stuff happens, and then Mrs. Thatcher deregulates the stock market and everything else. Like, that's broadly what people understand to be. Whereas we often describe it as, you know, because by no means is the show sort of a hagiography or a love letter to the post-war consensus, you know, especially because by the late 70s it is being held together with sellotape. That is the tone of the show, of like, if you want to really get behind it and keep it going together, the best you can do is just sort of keep that sellotape in place. You know, you can try and take some radical steps in various different directions. You can step to the right, step to the left. You can try and go down the middle and keep it all going. But I thought those were three really fascinating possibilities. And to see what a modern audience would do with that, with all their different biases, I think that's the interesting thing we've seen. Mm. We thought we'd kind of guess what sort of, you know, broadly liberal left-leaning audiences in theatre, which we often get, would want to do. It's been a lot more varied than we think. Yes. We've had people want to go very far to the left. Some people really reject actually going sort of down a Benite route, for example. We've had people, even quite left-wing audiences, actually like, no, they decide to actually almost steal Thatcher's clothes, as it were, and because one of the options is you can get a stockbroker to come in and assist you, and you can kind of end up getting Jim Callaghan to introduce a sort of light version of Thatcherism. And we call those nights the sort of New Labour early endings, where they end up pursuing a lot of things which, the argument they make is like, it's better us doing it than her, you know, and that's that's not something necessarily expected to happen as often as it
definitely
does.
Not, but it's quite common, yeah. And I think doing this show, when we were doing it in 2019, we were doing it against a background of Parliament being deadlocked again, you know, there being no overall majority. And that was really interesting, to be doing the show in November of that year. And we had the show on while the election happened. We got a little bit hubristic and we had a little election party, which ended up being quite depressing.
Oh, yeah.
For us, anyway. But yeah, I think that's been a really interesting thing as well, is tying it back to that era. And essentially, you know, these things just repeat, don't they? Yeah.
Is this weirdness where it does feel like essentially people's idea of British history, as they say, like the NHS, some kind of, you know, liberal. Swinging 60s. Yeah. Oh, well, Thatcher turned up.
Yeah. British Leyland, maybe? Yeah. That rings a bell. Like, yeah.
And it's just this utterly mad time. Like, you know, the kind of the. Yeah, the fact that there's almost a military coup, right? Yeah, like,
well,
yeah,
funny you should mention that.
Well, so this is the thing is that I assume, without wanting to ruin it for myself, as I am going to go, I assume that there are kind of failure states, one of which I would assume one of them is, you know, Mountbatten and co wandering in with the.
You might very well think that.
But did he? Because in some ways it is like a it's like a live action board game, and some people have been known to, you know, turn over the, you know, my partner actually, when she was about 13, was playing a board game with her sister, who's about a year older than her, and she turned over. Bear in mind, yeah, this is 14, right? You probably should not be turned over the table rather than lose. Do people ever turn over the table at any of the sort of more kind of?
They sometimes try.
Yeah.
You can't really, because you've got 35 audience in the room. The show's designed in such a way that no one person can dominate it to the extent that they completely skew what happens. So much requires the cooperation of different audience members together in order to get something done. And I guess that's the beauty of it, really. It becomes self-correcting. And all the shows we've done like this have had that built into them. I know with For King and Country, our World War II show, you know, you would have a war cabinet. Somebody would be chosen as the prime minister. If they then went on to make a boatload of stupid decisions, there'd be a vote of no confidence in them, and then it would shift, and the audience would do that themselves. We wouldn't even have to prompt it, because it's self-correcting. Mm. That provides a certain level of safety. You know, our fear in setting out to do this sort of thing was that the audience wouldn't go with it, or that it would sort of fall apart or crumble. What we discovered was that you can really rely on the audience wanting to have a good time. You know, they bought a ticket and they're there to play the game with you. It's very rare that you get people turn up to the theatre in order to have a fight. You know, they might go to the pub to get into a fight with somebody, but they don't come to a theatre to do that. So you've got a reliable group of people there every night who are going to want to have a good time and want to play the game with you. And so long as the game is robust, which it is, and we go to great lengths to make sure it is, then that will always work. It's interesting, we sometimes get like the theatre establishment be a bit sniffy about what we're doing. You know, it's not proper theatre because there's a game involved. But there is a huge lineage of this sort of work, particularly within political theatre in the 20th century. Bertolt Brecht famously said he wanted theatre to be more like a boxing match. He wanted to see people like on their feet, really invested in the outcomes of what was playing out on the stage. And I think we see that in our shows. Because people are able to get involved, they get really invested in what's going on. It's a lot like Boal's Forum Theatre, which is from the sort of 60s and 70s, where mostly in South America, he would take small communities, find out what the problem was in that community, and then create a show about it and allow the audience to change the show on the fly. I guess it's just that on steroids, really, what we're doing. We've built a structure that welcomes people into the same world as the actors, and then we allow them to play in it.
And I think and then just on the sort of turning the table thing, yes, obviously nobody likes to lose, inverted commas, and so on. Like, one of the things that we do though is we make the failure states, as you call them, if you're headed towards maybe, for example, not winning the votion of no confidence, for example, if it's looking like the show will rather decisively not do that, that's when some of the more interesting but still not necessarily good in terms of, you know, positive outcomes will come onto the table. But crucially, those outcomes are fun to play through. They give you new stuff to do, and they give you like a new extreme scenario to play through. So that does tend to focus. But if people are a bit like, oh no, we've really messed this up, actually their last 25 minutes of the show will be quite different, because suddenly we throw some new things at them based on how badly things have been going. We don't make people trudge through a sense of like, yeah, you're probably going to lose, you've lost. It's always a nail biter, or we see it coming and then some other problems come your way and you have to deal with those.
Avoid what I always think of as the Monopoly problem.
Yes.
Oh yes, yeah.
I'm always just astonished at, were people just more patient when Monopoly was tomorrow?
It's just a really bad game.
Yeah. Well, it does what it was originally meant to do, as I'm sure I don't need to tell you guys. Yeah. You know, it was meant to show that monopolies are bad and that land ownership shouldn't be handled that way and so on. So it teaches that. Well, I don't think it really does anymore, because people just think that it's not really fun or real. Yeah.
If you've been enjoying our podcast and want to find out more about what we think, and some of our colleagues too, then why not subscribe to The New Statesman? You can get 12 weeks for £12. Go to newstatesman.com/subscribe12.
Don't forget, you can now listen to our special Germany Elects podcast series, which explores the campaign, the runners and riders, and the big issues ahead of Germany's election on September 26th. Available now on the World Review podcast feed and at newstatesman.com/Germany.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So we talked a bit in the first section about games, because to editorialise from the internet, I always think one of the joys of it is the difference between theatre and cinema is that we, the audience, are there, right? And the magic of it is that there is a, you know, whether it's just the heightened emotion of watching it in the flesh, or in this case, the audience interacting and joining in the playing of the game, right? That is the thing that you cannot do in a view cinema, as lovely as view cinemas are. But I want to talk a bit about, you know, about board games. Yeah, so we usually ask our interviews to recommend sort of three things. So we recommend our kind of, you know, favourite board games.
Well, I suppose I should declare an interest, because it is by someone I know. But there's, speaking of Monopoly, someone I know has put together a game called Magnate, or Magnate the First City. And that genuinely came out of a desire to have a game that plays the way that you maybe as a child hoped Monopoly would. And it's a really fun sort of Euro game, if you like your board game terminology, version of sort of a property game, where you have a big map of a city and you've got these 3D buildings, and you buy land, you put the buildings on them, and then you have to move tenants in, and then you maybe watch the price, the land price go up. The property market is booming after all. But of course, at the end of the game, the market will always crash. It's got its own little political lesson there, but it's really fun to sort of be competing with other people to try and get your buildings as valuable as possible. But anything you do to improve an area is likely to help someone else's prices as well, and so on. And that's just like, it's a really fun, I mean, yeah, I'm really into economic games, as making Crisis what Crisis might suggest. And I've spent many hours playing Magnate, so I really enjoy that.
I'm big into economic-driven games as well. I love the sort of the 18XX series of games, the railway things. 1870 particularly is my absolute favourite, because the stock market mechanics in that I find absolutely fascinating. You can end up with a really rubbish railway system, but you can still pull off a win. So that's really good. I also love Twilight Struggle, as I'm sure many people do. Yeah. In fact, I'd love to make a show that was about that. That struggle, the Cold War. We haven't really wrapped our heads around exactly how to do that yet, but yeah, I think there's just something absolutely beautiful about the game, and it's so finely balanced.
For listeners who haven't, which I should, it's a brilliant two-player game. You can play it on Steam, you can play it in person, you can. So I'm about to go on holiday with, actually, by the time this is aired, but I will be mid-holiday with another couple, and we're discussing whether or not they also play board games. It's like, well, we could take Twilight Struggle, and it's like, I feel like you can't. It's a bit like, you know, when you watch, say, a couple play Articulate, which I don't actually think is a very good board game, but is great at causing fights.
Yes. Right?
Yeah. If you really want to make an otherwise happy couple scream at each other about how the clue was obvious, yes, then Articulate is great for that. Yeah. But it's quite complex, and, you know, it's a bit intense, and, you know.
You want to have a big fight over whether you should play Khrushchev's secret speech at that exact moment or not.
I think the thing that's really clever about it, Twilight Struggle, is it's very complex, but actually you can, when you're learning to play it, it's still really good fun, even though it takes a while for you to realise, oh, actually, that's actually the point of war games, right? That's this, yeah, and it's the way that it manages to keep it balanced right up until the...
It's astonishingly good, yeah. There's very few games that can match that, I think, yeah.
The other kind of, yes, we like to leave, as well as, you know, people should go out, see the play. Recommendations. So, yeah, if at the end of this someone goes, I desperately want to learn more about the 1970s, what should they go out and read?
Read Agent Lavender.
Tom's Thank book. You, Owen. Yes, you can find Agent Lavender and many other books at Sea Lion Press, my alternate history publisher. But, yeah, I mean, State of Emergency, Seasons in the Sun, Crisis What Crisis, Wellwyn Turner as well, is very good. They're all places that I basically stole and relabeled lots of anecdotes and put them into the show in various ways. So they're all fantastic places to start. And go and see This House or find it on NT Live if you haven't yet.
Yeah, super piece of work that is.
And we'll have to make a living in different ways. But I think the slight change, I think people always forget what a great historian Dominic Sandbrook is, because people associate him in the popular mind with that, oh, it's election time for the Mail to do one of those weird, you know, alternate histories where it's just like Ed Miliband became Prime Minister and the United Kingdom physically split into two strokes.
Yes.
And occasionally I have people around and I'll see they're seeing them and it's like, they're like, wow, you have a lot of Dominic Sandbrook. And I was like, no, it's really good, guys. Actually, it's really good. Yeah. Trust me on this. Yeah. At no point does the weird alternate history happen in, yeah.
Yeah, it's a bit like Morrissey, isn't it? It's like, so you feel, oh no, I've got these bits of his work.
You've written an alternate history about, yeah, this fascinating kind of thing, which is really widely believed, you know, and to the point in someone, I mentioned this, and they kind of said, oh, but he could have been. Look, I think we're now at the point where we can safely say that it would have come out from the KGB archive by this point, not least because, you know, it would be a tremendous boast, right? Final one is, you know, an alternate history you'd like to do next, whether it's play or something.
Oh, that's real good, isn't it?
Mm.
I mean, we've talked a bit about US elections.
Mm,
we've not settled on a particular era for that, but I think we would both be very keen to do an election-based show. Yes. I that's partly just through being massive fans of The West Wing as well, and the idea that if we had the budget, we'd make our own little kind of bit of the White House. But that would be something.
That one, yeah, picking a really interesting moment in history, and whether it's one of those where there were allegedly three candidates, you know, whether that's 92 or 68 or something, that'd be interesting. I guess then some people have to be working for George Wallace, which probably wouldn't be that. You might get some people wanting to do that. But another, actually, on a similar note, another thing that I'm interested in doing, I think we might have probably soaked up all of the possible sort of Labour geeks who want to come and see something like this. But if we did want to do like some kind of sequel to this, to Crisis, the idea I've got in my head is actually a sort of bookend at the other end of this period of Labour history, and do basically a by-election in the mid-90s, probably a fictional one to make it sort of have maybe different parties have got different chances, and then do something, because obviously if you do a show about the 97 election, however you do, everyone kind of knows how it's going to end. Yeah. But if it's sort of maybe 1995 by-election, it's like, right, okay, Tony's popular, let's show that he could win, et cetera, et cetera. But then I really like the idea of the dynamic of, as one often gets in by-elections, the local party who, you know these streets, know these wards, know what to do. And then particularly in the 90s, you know, the sharp-suited people from HQ come down and sort of ride roughshod over everything. And well, the clashes between those might be quite fun to play out, albeit very geeky. So that one might have to just reserve that one for a short story and put it on paper somewhere. But yeah, that'd be interesting.
I'm very much looking forward to seeing space. So, how can listeners go and see this play?
At the moment, we are sold out at time of writing and all that. We are, however, very hopeful to come back. The current run cannot extend any further, but if you'd like
to hand the building back, basically.
Yes, that's the issue. It's because it takes place, as in case that wasn't clear, on the floor of a real office building. So unfortunately, they need that floor back. However, if you go to parabolictheatre.com, so parabolictheatre.com, you can sign up to the company's mailing list. That will obviously alert you to as and when it's coming back. And you can also find us on social media as Parabolic Theatre. You can find me on social media as Tom Black UK on Twitter. Owen,
Owen Kingston on Twitter as well.
Owen Kingston.
Owen Kingston.
And there will be all of those channels will be shouting about it as soon as we possibly can. But
This is now the third run of this show that we've done. And there's clearly a lot more life left in it. So we're really keen to do it again. And it's really just a question of finding a building and hopefully finding people to partner with. The new Diorama Theatre have been absolutely amazing in making this run happen in the middle of COVID times. Essentially, they have taken all of the financial risk off our shoulders, which has been an absolute gift. So I think we've struggled to find better partners than that. Mm. But yeah, if we're able to find a place to do it again in the not-too-distant future, I think we're all guns blazing for that.
And on that note, there are very occasionally returns during this run, and the new diorama are the people to email about that. We'll keep an eye on their social media.
In fact, I think they're running a list.
You've been listening to the New Statesman interview with me, Stephen Bush. Our music is Devil with the Devil, which is licensed under Creative Commons. If you've enjoyed the New Statesman podcast, please do leave a favourable review and do make sure to check those books out from your local library or preferred independent bookstore.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.